Hello, and welcome to Vanguard Audiobooks. I'm Alex Linder, and you can find everything that we record as part of the Learning College at vnnforum.com. vnnforum.com. And today we're going to do the final volume, the final chapter, chapter 61 of Henry Ford's The International Jew, unabridged, written in 1920, written in 1921, published in the Dearborn Independent. That's a little town in Michigan. Paper owned by Henry Ford. He came across Jews in financing his automotive operations. You know, the first guy to set up a working line and really efficient and pay workers a high wage in order to have good workers and retain them. And he came across problems being caused in America, and he wanted to understand more about them and charged his researchers and his staff with investigating them. And the articles they produced were made into a book called The International Jew, The World's Foremost Problem. And in the last few chapters, we've been hearing about Jews in finance, and this will be the concluding one of that sort of subsection of this four-volume, 80-chapter work. So let's get it right into it. Chapter 61, Jewish Power in America's Money Famine. What is a money famine? The international Jewish banker who has no country but plays them all against one another, and the international Jewish proletariat that roams from land to land in search of a peculiar type of economic opportunity, are not figments of the imagination, except to the non-Jew who prefers a lazy laxity of mind. Of these classes of Jews, one or both are at the heart of the problems that disturb the world today. The immigration problem is Jewish. The money question is Jewish. The tie-up of world politics is Jewish. The terms of the peace treaty are Jewish. The diplomacy of the world is Jewish. The moral question in movies and theaters is Jewish. The mystery of the illicit liquor business is Jewish. These facts are unfortunate as well for the Jew, and it is squarely up to him to deal with the facts and not waste time in trying to destroy those who define the facts. These facts are interpreted by the Jew and the anti-Semite with strange extremes of blindness. The Jew never gets the world's point of view at all. He always gets the anti-Semite's point of view, and the anti-Semite is equally at fault in always getting the Jew's point of view. What both need is to get society's point of view, which is the one being set forth in this present series of articles. And again, this is a hopeless attempt to make a distinction between non-existent people who hate Jews for being Jews versus respectable people who hate them for specific reasons. In fact, they're the same people. There's no people on earth who hate Jews for being Jews. It's purely hatred for what they do and the way that they ruin things. I mean, it wouldn't even make sense to hate them for what they are if what they are wasn't, you know, indissolubly linked to how they behave. It'd be like hating an animal or something. It doesn't make any rational sense. To say that the immigration problem is Jewish, and remember, we had a massive wave of people coming to the U.S. after 1880, and this was the first time we had massive immigration from Southern and Eastern Europe, and this included many, many Jews immigrating legally and sneaking in illegally as well, because Jews do not respect any law that's not made by a rabbi. Goyish law has no hold on them. It's just something to be taken into practical consideration, i.e. if they could get caught, they might obey it, but they wouldn't obey it because they had any inherent respect for it. They don't. As you see typically with Orthodox on planes, they could give a damn what the stewardess is saying about where they need to sit. They just ignore. They don't pay attention to Goyim. They don't exist to them. They're just stupid animals. To say that the immigration problem is Jewish does not mean that Jews must be prohibited entry to any country. It means that they must become rooted to a country in loyal citizenship, as no doubt some are, and as no doubt most are not. Okay, that right there is crazy. Now, why would you want to admit any members of a group who are more likely than not to be disloyal? That is absolutely insane. To say that the money question is Jewish does not mean that Jews must get out of finance. It means that they must rid finance of the Jewish idea, which has always been to use money to get a stranglehold on men and business concerns instead of using finance to help general business. To say that the tie-up of world politics is Jewish does not mean that Jews as human beings are to be denied a voice in affairs. It means that they must give up trying to make the world revolve around the Jewish nation as its axis, or as its axis. To describe the influence of the Jew in the theater is not to demand that he leave the theater, but it is to demand that he rid the theater of his idea that sensualism is entertaining. So see, this is utterly, 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 completely foolish, because what he is demanding per his Christian assumptions is that the Jew, it's like demanding a tapir stop running around the floor of the jungle looking for vegetation to munch on. You're demanding a thing stop being what it is. He's assuming Jews have a choice in the matter, and that's the Christian fallacy. The Christian idea, and I've seen this literally put in the book Self-Determination by Rudolf Allers, a Catholic psychiatrist, is that if 1 in 1,000 changes due to studying Christian doctrine, that proves that the other 999 could too. But the other 999 not changing doesn't prove anything about just how strong those traits actually are. And Henry Ford is exhibiting that exact same fallacy. Yeah, you'll get a few Jews who will convert or stop being Jews or might recognize that the way that their people act is destructive, but obviously it's more genetic than cultural if Jews have always acted this way for thousands of years. And why in the world are they going to give up stuff that has given them every possible practical advantage in this, the only known to actually, no one disputes that this world exists. And when they get every possible advantage from behaving the way they do, and they've done this for centuries, you are an absolute fool if you think that you can reform them or make them want to change. They don't have any desire to change. Why would they have any desire to change? What they're doing is working. It's this insane stuff like Ford is pitching here that we just want them to stop being criminals and liars and murderers. Well, that's what they are, man. They're not going to change. You have to change. It's your attitude that has to change toward them. But then again, maybe I ought to turn that around and say, is it possible that Goyim can stop being suckers? Maybe it's not possible. Maybe we are just a race of congenital rubes. I mean, what can I point to in terms of Goyim growing wise to the Jews? I can point to a lot of quotations from individuals who understood the Jews. But en masse, where have we seen any actual resistance to them in a way that made logical, rational sense? I guess you'd have to point to the German nationalists. On that slender reed, our hopes must reside, I suppose. You certainly don't see any sign of Christians catching on to what's wrong with them. They define Jews wrong. I'm going to do a specific podcast about that later, because that's a very important portion of white education, what I've just been discussing here these few minutes. But it needs to be gone on into at length on its own. Anyway, Henry Ford says, the Jewish question is first for the Jews to solve. If not, the world will have to solve it for them. Yeah, I'm going to bet on that portion. They may stay in business, say the theater, for example, if they will cease spoiling the theater. If they do not cease, the theater will be taken away from them, just as certainly as that day follows night. Really? Has that happened? It happened in Germany, but it hasn't happened in the U.S. They've got worse and worse. More sensual, as he puts it. What would he say today about just open pornography that anyone can get on the internet? And pornography with a very political bent, emphasizing how much more desirable blacks are and how weak and wimpy whites are. What would he say about that if he could see what circumstances prevail today? And he says it's certain as night, as day follows night, that it will be taken away from them. Well, it's far from certain at all. It happened in Germany after Weimar. But it's never happened in the U.S. They went from strength to strength until they completely dominated. The world has been patient, and the world will be fair, but the world knows the limit of imposition. But what we know now, looking back from 100 years, is he's underestimating the strength of the Jews, and he's overestimating the strength of the world. And the Jews are proved right to stick by their guns. We can push it over on these people. They are too weak and too dumb and too scared and too cowardly and too simple-minded to resist us. The protocols are being borne out that other people are not in the level of the Jews. Can we say that they're wrong? We don't have a lot to point to if we do. Got to be honest, otherwise we're no better than black pride. Oh, we're great because we're white. Well, okay. You're born white. You know, you got to have a little more than that. It is not true Jewishness of the Jew. It is not the true Jewishness of the Jew, nor yet the nationalism of the Jew that is on trial, but is anti-national internationalism. Now he's going to try to make another logical fallacy. No true Jew would act like this. True Scotsman. A true Mosaic Jew, not a Talmud Jew, would be a good citizen. That is an Old Testament Jew versus a Talmud Jew. But everyone says that Talmud is what really tells Jews how to be and really defines them, not the Old Testament, as the Christians mistakenly think. A nationalist Jew would at least be logical. But an international Jew has proved an abomination because his internationalism is focused on his own racial nationalism, which in turn is founded on his ingrained belief that the rest of humanity is inferior to him and by right his prey. Jewish leaders may indulge in all the platitudes they possess. The fact which they cannot deny is that the Jew has for centuries regarded the goyim as beneath him and legitimately his spoil. Yeah. And that's very much in keeping. Where would we look to understand that? Christianity or nature? What would nature say about that? Christianity would say first, well, the Jew is being immoral. But what would nature say? Nature would say, yeah, that's tough cookies. That's how it goes. One wins, kills off the other. That's the principle we're built on. So nature is the way to understand the Jew. The internationalism of the Jew is confessed everywhere by him. Listen to a German banker. Imagine this slow, oily voice in which he said, "We are international bankers. Germany lost the war? What of it? That is an affair of the army. We are international bankers." And that was the attitude of every international Jewish banker during the war. The nations were in strife? What of it? It was like a Dempsey Carpentier bout in New York, in New Jersey, or a baseball game in Chicago, an affair of the fighters. We are international bankers. A nation is being hamstrung by artificial exchange rates, another by the sucking of money out of its channels of trade. What of it to the international banker? He has his own game to play. Hard times bring more plums tumbling off the tree into the baskets of the international bankers than does any other kind of times. Wars and panics are the Jewish international bankers' harvests. Citizens wake up with a start to find that even the white nations are hardly allowed to see each other nowadays except through Jewish eyes. When the United States supposedly speaks to France, through whom does she speak? All that France sees is Otto H. Kahn. Why must a Jew represent the United States of America to France? When France supposedly speaks to the United States, through whom is it done? Through Viviani, Jewish in every thought and method. Now they are talking of sending Millerand over, another Jew. Britain sends Lord Reading. Germany sent Dr. Dernburg. And to other countries, the United States sent Morgenthau, Strauss, Warburg, and lesser Jewlings. Jewlings, that's as close as they've gone to a slur in this series. It comes with something of a shock to learn that Folk is coming to the United States. That's Marshall Folk from France. We have not seen a Frenchman since Joffre visited us, Joffre. It is good to see a man of the white race come across the sea, as if to reassure us that white men still live in those countries. The business of the peace conference was done by Jews. Has it come to a point where international diplomacy is to become a Jewish monopoly also? Must the special conversations between France, Britain, and the United States be held through Jewish interpreters, while Anglo-Saxons and true Frenchmen do the routine embassy work? Or shall it be possible for the non-Jewish nations to see one another occasionally through non-Jewish representatives? Internationalism is not a Jewish conviction, but a Jewish business device. It is most profitable. In diplomacy and at the immigrant station, internationalism pays. Jews interpret nation to nation in the high rights of special conversations between governments. Jewish interpreters swarm at the ports of every country also, where the poor swam in. Swarm in. It was stated in the House of Lords the other day that most of the trouble in Palestine was caused by Jewish interpreters. It was charged that the Jewish administration added an extra language to the official list in order to make Jewish interpreters indispensable. Go through the government of the United States where the income tax secrets are kept, where the Federal Reserve secrets are kept, where the State Department secrets are kept, and you will find Jews sitting at the very spot where international Jewry desires them to sit, and where nothing is kept from their knowledge. That's a big thing with them, is, as we heard during the chapter discussing Bernard Baruch and the War Production Board, they get in positions where basically everyone is forced to reveal their secrets to them, or they can use their official authority to obtain those secrets. So either passively or actively, they're able to get the information they want in order to know what's going on. And like I've said, Jews are essentially people with invisible feelers. They have a sort of paranoia. They know everyone's out to get them because they know what they're doing. They know that's what they deserve. Everyone is, in fact, not out to get them, and in fact, is remarkably complacent about what they're doing because they simply don't have the same kind of mindset. But Jews are always positioning themselves to get all the information, by hook or by crook, as we know from the ADL bribing the cops to supply them with information for their files on 10,000 non-Jewish organizations they wanted to spy on. That famous case in San Francisco, now a couple of decades ago. Anyway, go abroad and come back to your country, and a Jew will open the gate to let you in, or close it to keep you out, as he chooses. Will you be going to Detroit while you are here? Asked a Jewish government agent of a gentleman entering the country on a visit a few weeks ago. I may go to Detroit, was the reply. Well, you go to the damn Dearborn Independent and tell them a Jew let you into the country, said the government agent. What the visitor replied is known, but it better not be quoted. The American Jewish Committee might shriek that the people were being incited to pogroms. Notice the tone is changing a little bit in these books. It's getting a little bit sharper as we move toward the final quarter. Although that may be a wrong way of putting it, although they somewhat have followed the chronologically, they're also somewhat grouped by subjects, so we can't say exactly for sure that it's getting sharper in tone, but I've noticed a sharpness in tone in the last couple of chapters that wasn't quite there. They used the word Jewlings, and they used a couple others formulations that were a little sharper. The incident, however, is but a sample of what is occurring every day. The truth about the Jewish question in the United States is perhaps the one form of truth that cannot be indiscriminately told. The truth about the Jewish question in the U.S. is perhaps the one form of truth that cannot be indiscriminately told. That means you can't simply state it. You have to be very cautious about to whom and where you reveal it. So, per that famous Voltaire statement, who are the powers that it's taboo to criticize? This is a different version of that same insight. The international Jewish bankers regard themselves as in similar fashion letting, quote-unquote, the nations do this or that, regarding the nations not as fatherlands but as customers, and as customers in the Jewish sense. If an army wins or loses, if a government succeeds or fails, what of it? That is their affair. We are international bankers, and we win whoever loses. For international Jewish bankers, the war is not over. The period of actual hostilities and the emergencies of the nations were but the opening of the trade. The ready cash was skimmed in then, all the cash the world had. True, some of it had to be distributed among the people as war wages and bonuses in order to keep the struggle going, but this was soon recovered through the means of high prices, artificial scarcities, and the orgy of extravagance deliberately organized and stimulated among the people. That phase over, and money disappeared. Is there any more tragic joke than that diligently disseminated in this country? The United States has more gold than any other country in the world. Unquote. Where is it? How long since you've seen a piece of gold? Where is all this gold? Is it locked up in the treasury of the United States government? Why, that government is in debt, desperately trying to economize, cannot pay a soldier bonus because the finances of the country cannot stand it. Where is that gold? It may be in the United States, but it does not belong to the United States. Remember, the U.S. was out of debt when Jews came into this country and took over the finances and set up the Federal Reserve. The U.S. had no debt. Now, as I speak on the first day of 2016, the U.S. is essentially bankrupt, other than its power to coerce money out of people. It's billions upon billions, if not trillions, in debt, if you want to count unfunded liabilities or unfunded entitlements, that is, things that it's legally by law forced to pay to anyone who meets the conditions. That's the definition of an entitlement. So there may be gold in the U.S., but it does not belong to the United States. The American farmer and those American industries which were not, quote, wise, unquote, to the tricks of international Jewish bankers and who were nipped by small loans are wondering where all this money is. Furthermore, Europe, suffering from every possible lack, is looking to us and wondering where the money is. This dispatch in a London paper may throw light on the matter. Italics are ours. Quote, it is learned today that new gold shipments aggregating 2,800,000 are consigned to Kuhn Loeb and Company, New York, making nearly 129 million imported by that firm since the movement started. In responsible banking circles, the belief is expressed that some of the German italics coin recently imported by the firm is italics from Russia instead of Germany. End italics, as generally supposed. So again, they're playing the old game of a cover nationality. This dispatch, coupled with one printed in a former article which showed Warburg and Company of Germany arranging with Kuhn Loeb and Company of New York for a $5 million loan to Norway, is not devoid of light on the question, where is the money? The Jewish international banking system may be easily described. First, there is the International Jewish Headquarters. This was in Germany. It had ramifications in Russia, Italy, France, Great Britain, and South American states. South American Jewry is very menacing, he says in parentheses. Germany and Russia were the two countries scheduled for punishment by the international Jewish bankers because those two countries were most aware of the Jew. They have been punished. That job is done. Jewish political headquarters, as related to the internal affairs of the Jews, was also located in Germany, but the headquarters dealing with the Goyim was in France. Statements have been made that the political center of Jewry has been transplanted to the United States, but these statements have been made by American Jews whose wish may have been father to the thought. During the Wilson administration, it was possible for a Jew to think and to hope this, but affairs have slightly changed. The ousting of American Jews from the Zionist movement at the behest of Eastern Jews indicates that if the political center of world Jewry has shifted to the United States, the power is still in the hands of aliens resident here. The center is still in Jewry. The United States is merely a square in the Jewry's world checkerboard. But wherever the financial and political world centers may be, each country is separately handled. In every country, the United States, Mexico, the Republics of South America, in France, England, Italy, Germany, and Austria, yes, and in Japan, there is an international Jewish banking firm which stands at the head of the group for that country. Thus, the chief Jewish firm in the U.S. is Kuhn Loeb & Company, of which one of the members is Paul M. Warburg, brother of M. Warburg & Company of Hamburg, Max Warburg, and another member of which is Otto H. Kahn, resident successively of Germany, Great Britain, and the United States, and self-appointed financial spokesman for the United States to France and Great Britain. Great Britain and France seldom see a special American spokesman who is not a Jew. That may be the reason why they reciprocate by sending Jews to us, thinking perhaps that we prefer them. But wherever the financial and political world centers may be, each country is separately handled. Now, we went over that already, that paragraph, saying that each country is separately handled, and that includes a lot of South America, and they more or less said South American Jews are particularly nasty. Paul M. Warburg, was the inventor, perfecter, and director of the Federal Reserve System of the United States. He is not the only Jew in the Federal Reserve System, but he was the chief Jew there. His mind counted for a great deal. There were others in the war government, of course. Bernard Baruch, Eugene Meyer, Jr., Hoover's Regiment of Jews, Felix Frankfurter, Julius Rosenwald, hundreds of them, and everywhere. But the financial group alone is receiving our attention just now, and they are not so notably successful in getting the country out of financial difficulty as they were in other lines of effort. The Federal Reserve System may not be a bad system, in spite of the fact that it yields government monetary functions to private financial corporations, but there are all sorts of testimony that it has been badly manipulated. Mr. Warburg, the reader will remember, spoke about certain things being, quote, overcome in an administrative way, unquote, showing that there was a certain amount of play or loose motion in the system which could be manipulated either way. The fact remains that the country went swimmingly through the war by reason of the assistance of the system and is coming very lamely through the peace as the result, monetary experts say, of the hindrance of the same system. Mr. Warburg, whose name was so prominently connected with the advertisement of the glory of the system, must also stand being mentioned in connection with the criticism. Whatever money we are said to have as the per capita in the United States, it is a false statement. The money per capita should always be figured on the basis of money in circulation. The statistical per capita is not always in circulation. Less than half of it, as a rule. The rest is being juggled. Whatever the gold in the country, the wealth is still greater. There is more wealth in the United States than there is gold in the world. 1 year's products of the farms of the United States exceeds in money value all the gold in the world. Yet, under our present system, the burgeoning bulk of the country's wealth must pass through the narrow neck of money, and the money must pass through the still narrower neck of gold. And the controller of the gold, under our present system, controls the world. There is more wealth than there is money. There is more money than there is gold. Money exists at the pleasure of gold. Wealth moves at the pleasure of money. Whoever sits at the neck of money, opening or closing as he will, controls the movement of the world's wealth. And the world's prosperity depends on the movement of that wealth. When wealth stands still and does not pass from hand to hand, the world's circulation has stopped. The world becomes economically sick. The scarcity of cash in hand has led to credit. Credit is a form of barter. It is a form of dealing by which many transactions are carried on, only the final one being cleared in money. It is a device which has its dangers, in spite of the efforts of apologists to exploit its advantages. But one thing the system of credit indubitably does, it allows the money masters to hang on to the cash. When the world is caught with paper, not with cash. The cash is always in the hands of those who extol the advantage of the credit system. Who holds money holds power, and will hold it until real barter or real money comes into fashion again. In 1919 to 1920, and remember, back then the dollar was convertible into gold. So it was paper, but it wasn't just paper. It was backed by something actual, which is not true today. It's not backed by anything except the faith and credit of the United States government, which is, you know, trillions in debt. In 1919-1920, according to one of the best monetary authorities in the United States, the total shrinkage in values of the products of our fields, mines, factories, mills, and forests represented a sum greater than the total gold supply of the world. It runs as high as the total amount of Liberty bonds outstanding. People say, well, the prices were too high. Certainly they were too high, but who and what made them too high? It was the generosity with which money was supplied by the private Federal Reserve System. There was plenty of money. People say, well, the shrinkage is only in paper values. The real value of the product is still there. Certainly, but when you live under a system in which, quote, real, unquote, value and real, and quote, money, unquote, value, when you live under a system in which real value and money value are so intimately intertwined that it affects your bread and butter, the tenure of your farm, and the steadiness of your job, it is pretty hard to separate the two. Moreover, when your prosperity was due to the readiness of a group of men to let out money, and your adversity due to the unwillingness of the same group, and your own welfare and your country's welfare is thus seesawed up and down without any reference to natural law, but solely upon determinations taken in committee rooms, you naturally inquire, who is doing this? Where is all the money gone? Who is holding it? Here is the wealth of the country. Here is the need of the country. Where is the money to transfer the wealth to the need? Every condition remains as it was, except money. We have a Federal Reserve System, which still is benefiting by the assistance of its perfecter and director, Paul M. Warburg. And what is the condition in the United States? Some of the biggest industrial institutions in the country now in the hands of creditors' committees. Farmers being sold out by the hundreds, their horses bringing about $3 each. Cotton and wool enough to clothe the nation, spoiling in the hands of the men who raised it and cannot dispose of it. Every line of business, railroading, newspaper publishing, storekeeping, manufacturing, agriculture, building, in depression. Why? For lack of money. Where is the money? This is a country that is supposed to be the financial center of the world. Where is the money? It is in New York. The Federal Reserve System, which Mr. Warburg desired to head up in one central bank, has just about turned out that way. The money is in New York. Here is the charge made to the governor of the Federal Reserve Board by a responsible public official who knows. While there is a scarcity of money for the producing sections of the West and Northwest, the South and Southwest, we find that individual banks in New York City are borrowing from the Federal Reserve System in a number of cases more than $100 million each, and sometimes as much as $145 million is loaned there to a single bank, twice as much as some of the Reserve banks have been lending recently to all the member banks in their districts. One bank in New York borrowed $134 million, or $20 million more than the Federal Reserve Bank of Kansas City was advancing to 1,091 member banks in that reserve district, which covers the states of Kansas, Nebraska, Colorado, Wyoming, and parts of Missouri, Oklahoma, and New Mexico. So one NYC bank gets more than 1,000 banks in the Midwest. At the same time, another New York bank was borrowing from the Federal Reserve Bank about $40 million, which was more than the aggregate loans which the Federal Reserve Bank of Minneapolis was lending to its 1,000 member banks in the great states of Minnesota, North and South Dakota, Montana, and part of Wisconsin. Another New York bank borrowed from the Federal Reserve a sum which was greater by $30 million than the Federal Reserve Bank at Dallas was lending to all the banks in Texas, Louisiana, and Oklahoma. Still another New York bank got a loan which equaled the total loans allowed by the Federal Reserve Bank of St. Louis to the 569 member banks of that very important district, which includes the whole state of Arkansas, parts of Illinois, Indiana, Kentucky, Tennessee, and Mississippi, and the larger part of Missouri. Take the Fifth Federal Reserve District, served by the Federal Reserve Bank at Richmond, Virginia. One New York bank was able to borrow from the New York Reserve Bank more than the Richmond Reserve Bank would lend to all its member banks in Maryland, Virginia, North and South Carolina, and the larger part of West Virginia. This is the situation. The 12 regional banks, which were supposed to make money serve all parts of the country equally, have apparently been, quote, overcome in an administrative way, to such an extent that the New York Federal Reserve Bank is to all intents and purposes the central bank of the United States and serves the speculative part of the country with millions, while the productive part of the country is permitted to wilt with paltry thousands. And that's the heavy part here of this chapter. When it can occur that four New York banks can borrow from the New York Federal Reserve Bank as much money as the banks of 21 states were able to borrow from the five Federal Reserve Banks of St. Louis, Kansas City, Minneapolis, Dallas, and Richmond, there would seem to be need of explanation somewhere. Where did this money loaned in New York come from? Why, it came from those parts of the country where money was scarcest. In May 1920, the word went out over telephones. Quote, the tie-up will come on the 15th. And it came. Credit was stopped. Payment was pressed. A stream of money, literally squeezed out of the producing sections of the country, began to roll toward New York. Otherwise, those giant loans just recorded would have been impossible. It was pressure, Federal Reserve pressure, politely known as deflation, and that is the way it worked. The banks of the West were squeezed dry that the banks of New York might overflow. The, quote, the money was withdrawn from legitimate business in various parts of the country to be loaned at fancy rates in Wall Street, says the official referred to above. The speculative banks, it has been discovered, were able to borrow money at 6%, which money they loaned at as high as 20, 25, and 30%. Federal Reserve deflation created a scarcity which speculative banks utilized. The Federal Reserve policy took the money out. New York banks borrowed the money taken out and loaned it at tremendous rates, rates which people paid to stave off the ruin caused by the moneyless condition which the ill-measured deflation process brought on. And all this time, the Federal Reserve System was in the best financial condition of its whole career. In December 1920, it had 45% of its reserves, which was a higher reserve than it had had in December 1919, a year earlier. But at this writing, in July 1921, the reserve had reached 60%. So the money is in New York. Go out through the agricultural states and you will not find it. Go into the districts of silent factories and you will not find it. It is in New York. The Warburg Federal Reserve has deflated the country. A system that was intended to equalize the ups and downs of financial weather has been used, quote, in an administrative way to deplete the country of money. The Federal Reserve idea was doubtless right. If it had not been, it could not have been established, and I would not accept that at all. It would be better if it did not exist. But it has been manipulated. It has not been a, quote, Federal Reserve. It has been a private reserve. It has been operated in the interest of bankers and not of everyone in general, capable of being used to carry the country gradually back to a natural flow of business and to a natural level of prices, they mean after the war. It was used to bludgeon business at a crucial time and to bludgeon it in such a way that the moneylenders profited when the producers suffered. If that is the fact, there is no American banker but will say that the method was wrong. Economically wrong, logically wrong, commercially wrong, if not criminally wrong. Today, the Federal Reserve boasts of its own reserve as if that were a sign of national economic health. With the country struggling to live, the Federal Reserve ought to be low, not high. The height with which the reserve is reached is a measure of the depth of the country's depression. If the Federal Reserve would let out a part of that flood of money, a high financial authority suggests that less than 10% would do it. It would be like an infusion of blood into the nation's veins. Kuhn Loeb and Company, the Spires, remember that's another, like Rothschild, that's another house out of Frankfurt, Germany, Jewish German financial house. Kuhn Loeb and Company, out of New York, the Spires and other Jewish moneylenders have money for Mexico, Norway, Germany, and all sorts of commercial companies being organized to do business overseas, and it is American money. The Warburg Federal Reserve System has been badly misused, badly manipulated, and the country is suffering from it. So see, they had not yet started running the presses back then. What they were instead doing the opposite and deflating, calling in their notes, and then distorting the economy by taking the money from these banks and investing it as they saw fit rather than as people in local communities would have seen fit to do. Still, the people know not what to do. Money is still a mystery. Banking is still sacrosanct. What would be perfectly apparent if done in ordinary business intercourse with a $5 bill is exceedingly complicated when the sum is $5 million and the parties are 1. Country banks, 2. Federal Reserve banks, and 3. Wall Street speculative institutions. Yet they are only Tom, Dick, and Harry with a $5 bill, after all. The matter is somewhat affected by the gags that are placed on many men competent to criticize. High officials are more or less tied up by campaign contributions in which all financial concerns have an interest. Legislative officials are, too many of them, indebted to these same interests. A schedule of the private debts of some of the men who have aspired to the presidency in the last 8 years would be very illuminating, almost as illuminating as a schedule of the names of Jews at whose homes they stayed while on journeys through the country. Men who are thus tied up with the present financial system cannot say what in their minds they know. It is all illustrated in the testimony of T. Cushing Daniel, C-U-S-H-I-N-G, Daniel, before a committee of the Congress. It shows to what an extent the power of this private corporation called the Central Bank can reach. Quote, from T. Cushing Daniel, like T. Boone Pickens. When going through the Bank of England, I presented a letter which I had from Secretary Hay, and the official of the bank was very polite. He took me through the bank, and when we got back to the reception room, I asked him if he would allow me to put a few leading questions to him. He said he would, and I asked him if he would give me a statement of the Bank of England. We do not issue statements. Does not the House of Parliament sometimes call on you for some statement as to the condition of the bank? No, sir, they do not call on us. How is it that some of these revolutionists, so-called, do not get up in the House of Commons and raise the devil to know something about what is going on down there? That would be the condition in our country. Oh, most of them are large borrowers from the bank, and we have no difficulty with them. And that closes the chapter 61 on the banking affairs. So the Jews revise our financial system by setting up what is in essence a central bank and sucking the money out of the country and using it to fund their own operations that are highly profitable or highly speculative. And the rest of the country is lacking the money to do business. So, nice situation. Every place that Jews touch withers is the greater lesson here. We're just talking about the URL term slash economy slash money. Anyway, thanks for being with me today, and I'll be back with you again real soon.